Next week, the Supreme Court will hear arguments from opponents of the Affordable Care Act.
Essentially, what the challengers are trying to do is take down the whole ACA.
They're betting on one thing.
That if you get rid of the ability of all these people to get their subsidies, they're not going to be able to buy the insurance and the ACA will crash.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Carolyn Beeler, in this week for Mike and Scott.
In the old days, you spent a lot of time at the patient's bedside, and now the common saying is that you spend more time with the computer.
You know, people will want to wait in my waiting room for me because it's me.
He was like, forget it, because I can't pay it out of pocket.
Trees can't move as fast as climate changes.
200 degrees is a lot more tolerable
than
one
would think. Am I an alcoholic?
You know, you think about it, a connected refrigerator
isn't
actually a horrible idea.
She's the first who's saying the emperor has no clothes.
On today's show, a West Philly kid turns dentist to the Royals. Republicans in Congress wage war on the medical device tax, and we delve into the history of the modern vitamin industry. But first up, the Supreme Court will consider a case on Wednesday that challenges one of Obamacare's key provisions, subsidies that make coverage affordable for millions of people who get insurance through federally run online marketplaces. The fate of the law could boil down to one single word in a 900-page document. That's according to Lisa McElroy, a Drexel University law professor and Supreme Court watcher who's here to talk about the case. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Hey, this is such an interesting case, Carolyn.
So the lawsuit targets 34 states that have opted out of running their own state insurance online exchanges, right? And is having the federal government run them instead. So what are the challengers saying is illegal about giving subsidies through these federally run online marketplaces?
Well, the Affordable Care Act is a very, very long statute. It's about 900 pages long. And if you remember back in 2012, when they first looked at the statute, the court did, there was some speculation of have the justices even read this whole thing. But there is a little tiny provision in the ACA that says that for someone to get a subsidy, they have to purchase insurance on an exchange established by the state. Exchange established by the state. And so the argument of the people who are opposing this, the ACA, is that people who buy their insurance on the federal exchanges are not eligible for those subsidies, and that's very clear right there in the language.
So only allowed to get a subsidy if you are in a state exchange. What is the federal government's answer to this argument?
Well, the federal government's answer to this argument is twofold. One, they say that's not what Congress intended, and that's very, very clear if you look at the rest of the Affordable Care Act, in which there are lots and lots of different places where they talk about exchanges generally, where they talk about the subsidies more generally, and they say that in order to read the statute like this, you almost have to force it to work like this. Of course, the other thing that the federal government has said as recently as a couple of days ago is that essentially, what the challengers are trying to do is take down the whole ACA, that if you get rid of the ability of all these people to get their subsidies, they're not going to be able to buy the insurance and the ACA will crash.
So you were talking about the plaintiffs in this case, four plaintiffs, and there has been some discussion about whether or not these four individuals actually have standing, so the right to bring this case.
Right. So standing is the right that a plaintiff has to bring a case in federal court. And what the court has required pretty much for the history of the doctrine, is that in order to bring your case, you have to be able to show that you have personally suffered some injury. So I can't bring a case on behalf of my husband, and he can't bring a case on behalf of me. I have to bring it myself. The issue that has arisen recently is that people are starting to question whether these particular four plaintiffs have actually been harmed, whether they would need to buy insurance on the exchange at all, because they're eligible for other forms of insurance or of health care. For example, two of them are Vietnam vets and therefore would be eligible for VA health care, wouldn't need to get insurance through the exchanges. What that does is it makes it possible that this case could go away if the standing issue, if the court said, you brought the case with the wrong people, we can't properly decide it.
So what will you be looking for when the news comes out on Wednesday about what kinds of questions the justices were asking? How much could that sort of tip their hand a little bit and tell you which way they were leaning on this?
So what they're going to be asking about a lot is what those words in the statute mean. And there are some justices on the court who think that you just look at the words, and if the words seem pretty clear, then you go with what the plain text says. Here it says an exchange established by the state. And the challengers are saying an eighth grader could understand that, right? It's very, very clear. On the other hand, the justices also like to look at a statute in context. So when they look at the language in one part, they don't want to make that mean something that would be inconsistent with the rest of the statute. So some of them will be asking questions about, well, if we say it's only state exchanges, then how is that going to work exactly? Because the rest of the statute won't make any sense. And then they'll certainly be asking about consequences. They'll certainly say, isn't this going to basically rip a huge hole in this statute? Won't it make the whole thing fall? And in fact, there's been really, really interesting commentary on the fact that back in 2012, when the court decided this case, the dissenters, the conservative justices, actually said, yes, take away the subsidies and the whole ACA falls. So that language is likely to be used against them.
When is the decision likely to come down on this case?
Well, the court always decides all of its cases by the end of June. Now, you should know that that's not an official date. It's just a date that's sort of customary. Given that this isn't being argued until next week on March 4th, and the end of the term will be the end of June, that really only gives them, what, about 12 weeks or so? Maybe it's 15 or so weeks. Not a long time if you're writing a very historic opinion that has huge impact.
So we'll all be watching until June to see what the court says. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us and explaining this all.
Thank you, Carolyn. It was fun.
Lisa McElroy is a law professor at Drexel University, briefing us on the King versus Burwell Supreme Court case to be heard Wednesday in Washington. Down the street from the High Court in the Capitol building, there's a second front in the war against the Affordable Care Act.
Because, of course, there's a debate going on in Washington about Obamacare and about the medical device tax.
A 2.3% excise tax on every sale that they make, hindering innovation and job creation.
A new tax on medical equipment makers' revenues, not profits, revenues, is now being called one of the most unfair taxes in health reform.
That I authored to repeal the destructive medical device tax. It's destructive.
Since Obamacare was passed, medical device manufacturers, think companies that make pacemakers and tongue depressors, have paid a new tax. Some of that money goes toward those insurance subsidies that make coverage affordable for millions of people. But a new Republican-controlled Congress is fighting to repeal that tax. Tanya English reports.
Way back when the Affordable Care Act was being drafted, the architects predicted that medical device makers would gain lots of new customers once more Americans gained health insurance.
So it didn't happen. We're not seeing an increase of business per se.
Carol Neubauer is chief executive officer of B. Braun Medical in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley. He says lots of newly insured people are young. That makes them less likely to be in the market for an artificial hip, a wheelchair, or the medical widgets that his company makes.
When you walk through a hospital, you'll see just a lot of B. Braun things.
Neubauer says the medical device levy is eating into his profits. The company has paid $24 million in taxes so far.
That's just money we don't have to spend. We had it 2 years ago. We don't have it anymore.
Machines hum 24 hours a day at the Braun factory in Allentown.
What you're looking at on this machine is a robot that's picking up the parts and the scrap plastic at the same time.
Plastic pellets are loaded up at the start of the production line. Along the way, that plastic is heated and molded into hundreds of different shapes. And at the end of the line, the machines spit out catheters, syringes, and IV tubes. 1,400 people work at the plant. Neubauer says some research, development, and construction projects are on hold. In early February, the company bused about 100 workers to Philadelphia for a repeal rally.
Repeal the tax! Repeal the tax!
The plan to revoke the 2.3% tax has backing from both parties. Senator Bob Casey, a Pennsylvania Democrat, is a supporter. But in Philadelphia, it was mostly Republican lawmakers who showed up to give speeches.
Thank you very much. And now Pat Meehan on the Ways and Means Committee. He's got the real job now.
Mold maker Josh Henritz was in the crowd.
This tax is going to prevent us from having new innovative products. It's going to take away all of our R&D money, so we're here to rally to repeal that. Everybody's going to be affected by this.
He's worked at B. Braun for 6 years.
It's a very good job. It pays very well.
The medical device tax is a job killer. That's how Paul Tui from Fuji Rabio Diagnostics sees it. But others question that claim. Tui says the big problem is that the levy is on company sales, whether or not a firm is making a profit.
We have not laid anybody off or cut jobs, but we had a vision and a mission to create more cancer tests, and the way to do that is to hire more research and development employees. We haven't been able to do that.
The medical device tax is supposed to raise about $30 billion over 10 years to help fund expanded health coverage. Some Democrats, including Delaware Senator Tom Carper, say they won't support a repeal until they see a plan to replace that money. But even without a plan,
that's not our job. The Congress will have to come up with that.
Paul Tui and other industry executives are pushing for repeal now. Economist Henry Aaron from the Brookings Institution says repeal advocates should also come up with ways to backfill the money. Have you heard any good ideas?
No.
Aaron has heard CEOs complain that their industry is hurting. One trade group surveyed device makers, and they say the tax has cost the sector 30,000 jobs.
Jobs are up, not down.
He's more inclined to believe analysts at Ernst & Young. It reports that the medical device industry has added 20,000 new jobs, and profits are up by 2%. Aaron says a repeal could succeed if it's folded into a broader bill that lets Democrats and Republicans trade favors.
The old tradition of what's called log rolling, putting together provisions that appeal to different members of Congress, whether that's going to happen this year or next year or the year after that, I don't know.
Staunch health law advocates want to hold the line. But Aaron says President Obama may be willing to deal because the medical device tax is not a tentpole provision of the health law.
Medical device tax, I've already answered the question. We are going to take a look at whatever ideas. Let me take a look comprehensively at the ideas that they present. Let's give them time to tell me.
That was Obama back in November, just after Republicans swept the election to control the House and Senate. But remember, the president still holds veto power, and repeal supporters concede they don't yet have the votes to override him. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Listening to The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler. Not every dentist gets to stare into the mouths of royalty, but one kid from West Philly got that unique honor. Thomas Evans earned fame, influence, and a sizable fortune by treating the teeth of 19th century nobles, including Napoleon III. His money would eventually pay for the stately Thomas Evans Building, home to the UPenn Dental School at 40th and Spruce. The building turns 100 years old this year, and we figured that was as good a reason as any to have reporter Todd Bookman tell the dentist's unlikely story.
The legend goes that his first patients were the dogs of 37th Street. Thomas Evans would wrangle them into submission, then fill their little animal cavities with whatever was lying around. The young Quaker plying his trade for the days when a human would let him do the same.
He was very much one of those sort of extraordinary 19th century self-made men who had decided at a very young age that he wanted to be a dentist.
Samuel Hughes is longtime editor of the Pennsylvania Gazette and has written at length about Evans. And he says by the 1840s, the 20-something is now licensed and working in Lancaster, PA. He specializes in gold fillings, the breakthrough material of the day. Evan's skill and early success catches the attention of one Cyrus Brewster, an American dentist living in Paris. In 1847, Brewster offers Evans a job. And this would set up a pivotal moment for the man, because a few years after arriving in Paris, one of Brewster's patients, Napoleon III, is in some distress.
Yeah, he had a bad tooth. He had a bad toothache and was apparently very sensitive to pain.
But Brewster, the head dentist, he is nowhere to be found.
Evans went in to see Napoleon, and Napoleon was very impressed with this young dentist who was also very caring and was also very skillful and also painless.
This is Dennis Kinane, dean of UPenn's dental school.
I think at that point, Napoleon III took him on as a confidant and also took him on as his own dentist. So it was a tremendous opportunity for Evans, and he grabbed it with both hands.
Napoleon III, the nephew of Bonaparte, appoints Evans to be the official surgeon dentist to the emperor. All of a sudden, he's the man, treating the wealthy, the famous, traveling by carriage to serve kings and queens. And this all at a time when dentists did not enjoy sterling reputations.
Apparently there was an expression in those days, a French expression, that was essentially to lie like a dentist. So they were not held in very high repute.
Evans elevated the profession.
He was instrumental in actually taking it from being quite a, let's say, a rudimentary art or a charlatan's art to actually being one which was, rubbed shoulders and joined the elite of other medical professions.
Part of this was simply an expectation that he be treated well. Napoleon, after all, had his back. But another factor was innovation. Evans was a pioneer in the use of nitrous oxide as an anesthetic, and he helped develop rubber-based dentures, as opposed to the expensive and uncomfortable metal varieties of the day. His notoriety across the continent kept expanding, as did his wallet.
I mean, he made a good deal of money, I think, as a dentist, but he probably made a lot more when they were sort of rearranging Paris.
See, Paris at the time was taking new shape. The crowded medieval neighborhoods were on their way out. Grand boulevards and parks were being built around town. And like any decent government program, there was plenty of cash to be made.
Well, he's probably one of the original insider traders.
Evans would sit in on Napoleon's meetings, getting the skinny on where to invest.
And Evans listened to the discussions and gave advice, but also then went out and bought, you know, tracts of land which the government were then going to build on.
Evans, in short order, is filthy rich. He starts buying up art, including several Manets who he knows personally. He takes on a mistress, renting her an apartment and a summer cottage. And there's also diplomatic missions. With Napoleon's support, he sails home in 1864 to meet with President Lincoln to get an update on the Civil War, reporting back that the end of fighting was on the horizon.
I mean, I think you could think of him as being the, let's say, the 19th century version of Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was in Paris and had a kind of similar exciting life when he was there, and was also involved in diplomacy with respect to the American War of Independence. And you could imagine that Evans did something similar when he was there in Paris 100 years afterwards.
Evans lives out his days in Paris, dying in 1897 at the age of 73. In his latter years, he thought hard about his legacy and what to do with the $5 million he had in the bank. His will lays out two priorities.
We can see it through the trees. You can kind of see it popping up through the trees.
The first is a proper gravesite back in America. And that's what Jessica Baumert is here to show off. She's director of the Woodland Cemetery in West Philly, where Evans is memorialized with a 90-foot-tall granite obelisk, believed to be the tallest monument in the country for a non-president. It dominates the 53 acres, surrounded by stonework and shaded by a towering tulip tree.
Creates kind of its own room within the cemetery, so it does feel like a very special spot.
Does it strike you as arrogant?
Yes, absolutely. I think it strikes everyone who sees it as arrogant. And people's reactions are usually, whose monument is this? And then I tell them and they're like, because it is, it's one thing to have somebody put up a monument after someone dies like that, like the Washington Monument, but to make the decision while you're still alive that you want something that's this ostentatious built for yourself upon your death is pretty arrogant.
But before we cast off Evans as an egotist with no heart, let's remember priority number two, and that's the Evans Building. Along with the obelisk, he left a sizable chunk of money to build a dental school and museum, which eventually finds a home on the corner of UPenn's campus. That imposing structure is celebrating its 100th birthday this year. Thousands of would-be dentists have mastered their trade inside those walls.
I don't think he was big on modesty. I think he actually, did take himself quite seriously. And, good enough for him because he did actually do a lot for dentistry and he did do a lot for mankind in his life.
Dean Kinane says there's plans to begin a complete restoration of the building later this year. Too bad Evans isn't around to pay for it. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Coming up on The Pulse, what if you actually knew the price of a mammogram before getting one done?
We're bringing transparency to the healthcare marketplace by telling people what stuff costs.
A new crowdsourced database could help you shop around. That's next on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. Independence is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Carolyn Beeler, in this week for host Mike and Scott. Have you ever tried to find out how much a medical procedure might cost, but no one could tell you? Well, you're not alone.
So I called around to a lot of different hospitals to find out how much amniocentesis cost.
How much was the CT scan going to cost?
No one would tell me.
And the two nurses just looked at each other in shock, like, we don't know.
I ended up getting a bill a month later saying that it was $1,000 more.
It could put me in overdraft or serious financial difficulty.
Today at The Pulse, we're launching a new project to lift the veil on some of these oh-so-mysterious costs. We're calling it WHYY Price Check, and we're working with the company Clear Health Costs to create a crowdsourced database of local medical procedure prices. There is a catch, though. As Alana Gordon explains, for this to work, we need your help.
Haircuts, houses, plane tickets, computers. Have you ever bought any of these things without knowing the price before and then just paid the bill after? Chances are not. You probably checked Amazon or Expedia first. But Jeannie Pinder says that's how healthcare works.
Nobody has any idea what things cost.
Pinder is a self-described careful shopper. She used to be with the New York Times, and a few years ago, she started a company called Clear Health Costs. The goal is to make prices more transparent.
What a revolutionary idea.
She's been creating a searchable database of price information for about 36 medical procedures. Think mammograms,
vasectomy,
MRIs,
Botox LASIK,
colonoscopies,
birth control pills.
The list goes on. To get a handle on costs in a region, her company crunches Medicare data. It surveys hospitals, providers, and insurers directly for their self-pay charges. That information can be really hard to get, and it's inconsistent, which is where you come in. The crux of this database comes from crowdsourced information people provide from the bills or insurance statements they got for a procedure. Pinder did a trial run of this in New York and California, and she found that prices for the very same medical procedure may vary up to tenfold from place to place.
For most of us, we have the impression that prices are more or less uniform, or perhaps that they're regulated. Most people are shocked when they get these gotcha bills, even for routine things like a colonoscopy or a mammogram.
Other research echoes this, and early returns in Philadelphia are showing variations too. Pinder says it's a big problem. People are bearing a greater brunt of the costs through health plans with higher deductibles and out-of-pocket spending.
Medical bills can be ruinous.
So the Pulse is now partnering with Clear Health Costs to help build a crowdsourced database of prices right here in the Delaware Valley. We're calling it WHYY Price Check. But here's where you, the listener, come in. We're asking you to find your medical bill or insurance statement and fill out a simple online form. You can do that at whyy.org/pricecheck. It's confidential, and this is a little different from our normal reporting approach, but we're interested in learning the price you were charged and the price you paid for a variety of medical procedures, even if you have insurance. To start, we're especially interested in hearing about colonoscopies and mammograms. Why?
They're fairly common procedures. There are, I think, 34 million mammograms performed in this nation annually.
Look, we know that healthcare costs are complicated and prices are not straightforward. But the hope is through crowdsourcing your experiences and doing more reporting in the coming months, we can gain a better understanding of healthcare prices in this region and a better idea of what things cost before going in for that procedure. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
It's never easy to decipher medical bills, so to see a video of how to find the right figures and use this online database, go to our website at whyy.org/thepulse. If you have any questions throughout the process, write us at pricecheck@whyy.org. As Alana mentioned in her story, Clear Health Costs projects in other cities have already shown a huge variation in what procedures cost at different hospitals. Lisa Alaferis has been tracking the project's results in California. She's the health editor at KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, and she joins us now to talk about what she's found. Lisa, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be here, Carolyn.
First off, navigating medical bills to find out what procedures actually cost isn't always super straightforward. Did you get a lot of people to submit their information?
We did. When we launched, we kind of held our breath, and we've been delighted at the response we've gotten. Hundreds of people have shared their prices. Thousands more searched the database that we created.
And with those hundreds of people's information, what did you find? How much did you find that medical procedure costs varied?
We specifically called out on air for four different procedures over the course of the project. We started with mammograms. That's a procedure that's done 38 million times a year. What people told us was that what their insurers paid ranged from $128 on the low end to $694 on the high end. So that's a pretty substantial variation right there. For lower back MRIs, which we called out for the second month, we found that what insurers paid for a lower back MRI, that ranged from just under $470 to more than $1,550. So there is money to be saved out there if patients or consumers think to ask.
So is that $694 mammogram a lot better than the $128 one, or was the hospital in a richer neighborhood or something? What do we know about why these prices are varying so much?
That's an excellent question. And there's really no connection between cost and quality in American healthcare. Yeah, we're Americans. We think that we pay more and somehow that something is better. But that is simply not known in American healthcare. So we can't know what it was that was driving the higher or the lower price. There could be a lot of factors involved. But the important thing is that, you know, lots of people have high deductible health plans now. And for things that you can schedule, it behooves people to ask, how much is this going to cost at your facility? Sometimes that information is hard to get to, but you won't find out, you won't ever be able to find out unless you start asking.
So what are you hearing from patients about their healthcare costs and this big variation that you're finding?
We have a comment space in the form, and believe me, we've heard from people. One person wrote, I was told the procedure was $1,850. I have a $7,500 deductible. So I talked to an office manager who said if I paid up front and agreed not to report it to the insurer, that it would only be $580. So this person's price went from $1,850 to $580 simply by saying, I'll pay the cash price right now, cash on the table.
Is that okay? Is that following all the rules in this situation?
Great question. No, it is not. When a provider is not supposed to let someone pay cash, they are supposed to insist on the insured price. Patients are not supposed to do that either. But in this case, this person was looking at saving $1,300 or so. That was the decision that was made. We also heard from physicians, from physician groups who were initially, I could tell with the first conversation I had, there was some skepticism about what we were trying to do here. And I invited them to please partner with us. We had physicians ready to share their self-pay prices, their cash prices, with price checks so that people could see what it would cost at their facility. We had other physicians, of course, were a little more fearful. But one physician I spoke to said, you know, doctors have got to get on the train. The transparency train is leaving the station, and they can either join or be left behind.
And part of the reason that costs are more important than ever is because more people have these high deductible plans, so they have to pay more out of pocket up front if they haven't met that deductible. So if I'm a person who hasn't met my deductible yet and I'm looking for a procedure that you don't have data on, so, you know, it's not a mammogram or a lower back MRI, do you have any tips on how to make sure I'm not paying more than I have to?
I would say that just asking every time you interact with a doctor or with a provider of any kind, asking what the price is. The more people are asking, the more it helps to contribute to the national discussion that we're having about healthcare costs and prices in this country.
Thanks so much, Lisa.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Lisa Alaferes is health editor at KQED in San Francisco. After our show, stay tuned to Radio Times at 10 a.m. as Marty Moscowane takes your calls about Clear Health Costs and talks with founder Jeannie Pinder. Coming up on The Pulse, how much do we really know about vitamins?
And so one day when my husband asked me, what's a vitamin? And I opened my mouth to answer, and I was like, I have no idea.
Tracing the history of those 13 special chemicals that keep us alive, next on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Vitamins are everywhere. They were probably added to both the cereal you ate this morning and the milk you poured over it. And every year, Americans spend more than $5 billion on multivitamins alone. All these vitamins must be making us healthier, right? The author of a new book argues it's not so simple. Catherine Price wrote Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you write in your book that we all know or think we know that vitamins are good for us, but we don't really actually know what they are or anything about them, really. So can we start with a definition? What exactly are we talking about when we talk about vitamins?
Well, many people hear the word vitamin and they think that it's the entire category of dietary supplements, and that's actually incorrect. So there's only 13 human vitamins, and that is A, D, E, K, C, and the 8 B vitamins. The question of what a vitamin is an interesting one because there's no chemical definition of the term. So basically, if you really want to get technical, the vitamins are the 13 chemicals we choose to call vitamins. And the word was created before anyone actually isolated a vitamin. And that was a combination of the Latin word for life, vita, and then amine, which was the type of chemical they thought all these vitamins would be. Turned out that wasn't actually true. They chopped the E off eventually to make it not as chemically inaccurate. So now it's just kind of this fantastic marketing word that doesn't really have a definition, but we're never going to give it up.
Once these vitamins were discovered, a lot of your book focuses on the industry that sprung up around that to fortify our foods. And a statistic I thought was particularly telling is that you cite a 2011 study that found that without synthetic vitamins in our fortified foods, the average American wouldn't be getting their estimated average requirement for vitamin D, A, C, E, B6, and folate, which is one of the B vitamins. So people, I assume, used to be able to survive eating, you know, unfortified foods before people discovered what vitamins were. So what's changed about our food system?
Well, a lot has changed about our food system. I mean, I guess at first I'd say that I wouldn't idealize, you know, people's diets in the past just because you hear about things like scurvy, which is the deficiency of vitamin C, and this disease called beriberi, which is a horrible disease where it causes paralysis and swelling and you eventually die in suffocating convulsions. So it wasn't like there weren't problems before. But in general, I find it really interesting to think that a lot of these nutritional deficiency diseases have to do with things that seem like human progress. So with beriberi, the thiamine deficiency disease, it was the development of these mechanical milling methods that enabled people to make white rice. And with scurvy, it was the ability to have these ships that could go offshore for months at a time. So you'd have these sailors who had to eat, you know, biscuits or whatever, and then became deficient. So these days, what I think is really interesting is that we've kind of developed this food system where we rely heavily on processed and refined products that are made from refined grains. And I mean, frankly, there's no real way you'd have the American food system without these products because we have, you know, grocery stores that require long-lasting, shelf-stable foods. And when you make foods like that, you unfortunately destroy a lot of the food's natural vitamins. So the result is that a lot of the vitamins in foods like bread or milk or orange juice, any of these things, are synthetic additions. And what I'd never really thought about and what that study you're talking about showed was that we're really dependent on these vitamins in a way that I at least had never really realized.
I think one of the takeaways from your book is that a healthful diet is a variety of fruits and vegetables, trying to avoid processed foods, mm-hmm. you know, as much as possible. So what are you trying to change about the way we think about food with your book?
So yeah, it's interesting because I think that as I learn more about the story of vitamins in particular, I began to believe that vitamins themselves really kind of open the door to the way we think of nutrition right now because they really, you know, they are miraculous. Like if you give someone vitamin A who is nutritional blindness, they'll regain their sight. So they do have magic power or seemingly magic powers when you've got a real deficiency. But those magic powers were capitalized on by food marketers and later the dietary supplement industry to, you know, they expanded those powers to substances A, beyond vitamins, and B, to make vitamins seem like they could do things beyond what they actually can do. So, you know, if you can cure nutritional blindness with A, then with a small amount of A, then what happens if you give a ton of A? And actually, bad things happen, so don't do that. But anyway, I started to view vitamins as kind of this gateway to how we think about nutrition. And the more I learned about how much we still don't understand about vitamins, the more I thought about vitamins as a cautionary tale for how we think about nutrition as a whole. So what I hope people will take away is to better understand how we got to the point where we do think about food in such a reductionist way and to give people a toolkit and a better, you know, set of techniques to evaluate the claims that we're faced with every day so you can make more intelligent choices about what you eat.
So if I eat a relatively healthy diet, you know, throw some kale in there every once in a while, do I need to take vitamins?
Probably not. First of all, like we were talking about, there are so many synthetic vitamins in our food supply that chances are you're not deficient in a vitamin. Or I guess I'd say there's particular circumstances where you might be concerned. Like if you're a vegan, you might want to watch out for B12 because it's only made by animals. If you're a woman of childbearing age, you should pay attention to folic acid because it's very important for the prevention of neural tube defects, which are a potentially devastating birth defect. And you have to have enough of it before you get pregnant. So you can't just like start taking a prenatal vitamin when you already know you're pregnant. And then vitamin D, like the jury's still out on that one. I know everyone's obsessed with it. In reality, experts know very little about what it actually does and how much we need and what the deficiency, you know, definition of deficiency should be. But it is true that it's found in very few foods naturally. Like unless you really love fish liver, you're probably not getting a natural source of vitamin D. That one I do kind of think is worth considering supplementing. But other than that, no, you're probably fine.
All right. Catherine Price, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Catherine Price is a journalist and author of the new book, Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. This is The Pulse. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Medical students spend four long years studying the science and theory of modern medicine, treating patients only under close supervision. But when the all-knowing resident's gone and there are no books to reference, treating a real-life emergency gets a whole lot scarier. Daphne Owen learned that lesson the hard way on a recent cross-country flight. She's in her final year of med school, and at a bar one night, she told regular Pulse contributor Avir Mitra a tale of a flight that started as a simple journey and ended as a medical student's worst nightmare.
All right, so here's the story. It was Thanksgiving. I had gone home to California, flying back to Philly. So I had a layover in Chicago. So it was maybe 10 or 11 o'clock, and I was like, all right, you know, I'll have a Chicago-style hot dog. I'll have a couple beers. I'll get on the plane. I'll sleep. It'll be great. Plane took off, and we were in the air for maybe 10 minutes when all of a sudden I heard a scream in the back of the plane. I mean, and it was a scream. Like, I turned around and looked, and I was like, what is going on? It was high-pitched, the kind that makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up a little bit. And then the stewardess came on the intercom, and she said,
is there a doctor on the plane?
And my heart sunk, and I thought, oh, my God, is there a doctor on the plane? Because I'm not a doctor. So I looked around, and I waited, and I thought, come on, there's got to be somebody on this plane. So I waited, and I waited, and nobody got up. And so finally I was like, all right. I had my little doctor bag in my backpack with my stethoscope and my pen light, you know, and my, like, reflex hammer that I'm not even really sure I know how to use. So I picked that stuff up, and I went to the back of the plane. There was this woman crumpled on the floor in the back. But she was just laying on the floor and not moving too great, eyes closed. So I introduced myself to the flight attendant. So I said, hey, you know, my name's Daphne. I'm a medical student. I'm not a doctor yet, but I'm happy to take a look and try to help out. Flight attendant was totally frantic. So she's like, okay, great, doctor, that's great. I told her again, you know, I'm not a doctor, but I'm happy to take a look and help out. So I got down on my hands and my knees, and I kind of like tried to wake her up, tried to ask her some questions, and wasn't really getting a whole lot. And like quickly I started to get nervous because I was thinking, all right, she looks young and healthy, but she kind of like wasn't really waking up. And I started feeling for her pulse. And I, like, couldn't really find her pulse. And I was like, is this, like, what's going on? Did I just have a couple too many Miller Lights? Or is, like, is she actually not okay? And it was one of the moments in my life when I felt the most aware of my insignificance and possibly incompetence. Because I realized that for the first time, I was really alone. I opened her eyes and her pupils were a little dilated. And I was asking her, you know, did you have any drugs? Did you have anything to drink? And just something just didn't seem right. It was making me nervous. And the longer I sat there, the more nervous I got. And then the stuff that started going through my mind was like, oh my God, what if she had a seizure? What if she's having an arrhythmia? What if she's in AFib? Like, what if she's septic? What if she's really, really sick? Like, what if? And I like totally started to panic a little bit. And then the flight attendant said, "Doctor, doctor, the pilot wants to know if we should land the plane." And I was like, "I told you, I'm not a doctor, I'm a medical student." And she said, "But they want to know if we should land the plane, what should we do?" And I was like, "Oh my God, nobody's ever really asked me for my opinion without a backup or someone to ask." Okay, so the pilot's asking, "Should we divert the plane?" You know, I really wanted to like phone a friend and call an attending and be like, "Hey, here's the story, should we land the plane?" So again, the flight attendant said, "Doctor, the pilot wants to know if we should divert the plane. What should we do?" And I thought, oh my God. And I said, "All right, well, listen, tell the pilot to just drive faster." So the pilot stepped on the gas. Finally, start to feel the plane land. And now the woman's sitting with me and she's talking with me and she's doing okay. And I guess the lucky part is by the time she got off the plane, she walked off and she was totally fine. But I didn't walk off the plane feeling like a hero because, first of all, I hadn't done anything. And second of all, I wasn't even really sure what had gone on. Well, I think it made me realize that I have a long way to go to feel comfortable taking care of patients completely on my own. I'm really glad that there's residency. You know, I'm on the right path, but I'm not there yet.
That was Daphne Owen talking with regular Pulse contributor Avir Mitra. Postscript here, Owen has decided to go into emergency medicine, the field she says you choose when you want to be really useful if someone's sick on an airplane. Our final story this week can be filed under the Found Moments category. Pulse reporter Alana Gordon was rushing through a hospital lobby on her way to an interview recently when she stumbled upon a spontaneous performance and pulled out her microphone. Linda Wang, a medical student from Canada with a hankering for jazz, was just passing through Philadelphia when she discovered a well-worn piano in the lobby of Perelman's Center for Advanced Medicine.
So I'm sitting in the lobby of the Perelman Center for Advanced Medicine, apparently, of the University of Pennsylvania Hospital.
Hey, Mr. Blue, I have to go now, darling, don't be angry.
I saw that someone was playing it, and, you know, it just said on the sign that you could check in with the information desk to play, and they said sure, so it's been a really good afternoon.
I'll leave you with a smile, kiss you on the cheek, and you will call the trees. That's the way it goes. Some days a fever comes at you without a warning.
So my name is Linda Wang. I'm a medical student from the University of Alberta. Just passing through Philadelphia and finding this beautiful piano here.
Mr. Blue, don't hold your head so low that you can't see the sky.
And so you like to find public pianos?
Yeah, I generally just pass through and search for any pianos that will allow me to play them. And I do meet the most interesting people, and I think this has to be one of those occasions.
Mr. Blue, I told you that I love you, please believe me.
I basically do this whenever I have a break, so, you know, often the hospitals have a piano in the lobby, and when I'm on call and I don't have a patient to see, I usually just go and play for a while.
What do you like to sing?
I sing a lot of jazz. I also listen to a lot of folk and pop, and I just, whatever's in my head, I guess.
So you're kind of doing this in between break right now from med school?
Yeah. I actually just finished my residency interviews, and so I have a few days off. I just came to visit my boyfriend and his family.
How's this piano?
It's a very nice, it has a lot of age and character, but the pedals don't work.
So tired, hopes where I'm as my winter coat to keep out the cold. But try as I might, I can't hide the mysteries that you read in my eyes. But oh, no, no, no. Oh, no, no, no. Wrap my heart in cellophane, keep it dry when it rains, and maybe that way I'll keep it safe from you.
That was Linda Wang, a medical student who fills her free time by playing pianos wherever she can find them. Alana Gordon produced this story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Avery Brookins is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news here, and Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous episodes, you can, no, you should, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Now, grab those medical bills you have filed away and stay tuned for a conversation about the WHYY Price Check Project on Radio Times. Our fearless leader, Mike and Scott, is back next week with more stories of health, science, and innovation. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for listening.